Welcome to NTD Evening News. Our top story tonight, former President Trump fined and threatened with jail time for violating a gag order. That's as Trump wraps up day 9 of his criminal trial in New York. Our legal correspondent Arlene Richards is at the courthouse with the latest. A building stormed and barricaded by student protesters at Columbia University. Fiona Ji has more on the overnight escalation and New York Governor Kathy Hochul's response. The White House calling that building takeover absolutely wrong. The prospect of the National Guard stepping in and Trump's latest comparison of campus protests to January 6th. Iris Tao reports. Democrats and Republicans unite to address anti-Semitism on college campuses. The House now poised to pass a bill aimed at tackling the issue. Luis Martinez on Capitol Hill. The Israeli police release a disturbing video of a terrorist attack in Old Jerusalem City. This comes as Secretary of State Antony Blinken is trying to help keep stability in the Middle East. Jason Perry has the war updates.
This is NTD Evening News. Live from our NTD global headquarters in New York City, here is Tiffany Meyer.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. Former President Trump has to pay $9,000. The judge in his campaign finance hush money trial found he violated his gag order 9 times. Judge Juan Merchan fined the former president $1,000 for each violation. Trump must also remove 7 posts from Truth Social and the 2 from his campaign website before this afternoon. The judge rejected the arguments by Trump's defense team and ruled that reposts on social media are endorsements. The judge threatened to put Trump in jail if he violates the gag order again. There is a court hearing set for Thursday to determine some remaining allegations of times when Trump violated the gag order. In the trial today, the prosecution called a series of witnesses who helped them introduce more evidence. One of the witnesses detailed the negotiations with Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen. Our legal correspondent Arlene Richards has the latest from the courthouse.
Breaking news, a full panel of appellate judges have denied former President Trump's motion to delay the trial. His attorneys had asked the court to delay the trial until after they heard appeals on their claims of presidential immunity and to recuse Judge Juan Merchan. Now to the trial. First up this morning was Michael Cohen's former banker, Gary Farrow. Now, Farrow testified that he helped Cohen to open an account that was eventually used to pay Stormy Daniels $130,000. He testified that Michael Cohen told him the account would be used for real estate consulting and that if he knew it would be a shell account, he never would have opened it. On cross-examination, he testified that he never directly spoke to Trump and that he had no reason to believe that Cohen would be involved in any political activity. Now, other witnesses this morning were an executive director for C-SPAN Archives and a field director for a court reporting company. Their testimony was only less than 20 minutes, but it was used to show the jury videos and transcripts of Trump admitting that he had made disparaging remarks about women in an Access Hollywood tape. What stands out for me with Keith Davidson's testimony is the conversations he said he had with Michael Cohen. Now, Keith Davis represented Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal over their deals to keep quiet about affairs they say they had with Trump, which Trump denies. He said that Stormy Daniels' story wasn't that interesting until after the Access Hollywood tape was released, and then it skyrocketed. Now, the National Enquirers had already made a deal with Stormy Daniels' agent, but then the National Enquirer dropped out of the deal, and they connected him with Michael Cohen. He said he never really wanted to deal with Michael Cohen because conversations with him were always contradictory. But he did eventually talk to Michael Cohen and they made a deal. But he said the deal was that he was supposed to make the payment by October 14th, 2016. But Cohen didn't make the payment on that date. And after several days, Davidson told him the deal was off and that he no longer represented Stormy Daniels. He said Michael Cohen complained that he couldn't get a hold of his guy. And then he eventually said, I'll just do it myself. So Cohen did eventually make the payment of $130,000. Now, Davidson said that he later spoke to an editor at the National Enquirer who told him that Trump was tight, and he said that he thought that meant that Trump really didn't have the money. Now, all of this testimony today was to provide evidence to the jury that Trump made this $130,000 hush money payment, and also, I think, to convince them that Trump probably did have those affairs. Back to you.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has issued a statement as pro-Palestinian student protesters stormed and barricaded themselves in Columbia University's historic Hamilton Hall. NTD's Fiona G has the details.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul on Tuesday condemned the illegal activities of agitators on Columbia University's campus. She reiterated students' rights to learn and graduate safely.
Every American has a First Amendment right to peacefully protest and assemble. But when actions cross over into vandalism, harassment, destruction of property, or even violence, then the line has been crossed.
Student protesters stormed the building today. This came as Columbia started to suspend students for ignoring the 2 p.m. disbursement deadline set on Monday. Campus newspaper The Columbia Spectator reported that dozens of students stormed Hamilton Hall, smashed windows, and barricaded doors.
Palestinian and Intifada flags have been draped out of the windows of Hamilton Hall.
A group called Columbia University Apartheid Divest is demanding divestment from Israel, financial transparency, and amnesty for student demonstrators. Protesters say they will not leave the building until these demands are met. Columbia University issued a statement Tuesday announcing increased security measures. All but one entrance point to campus is closed. No press is allowed on university grounds. Only students living in residential buildings and essential staff members have access to the campus. There is no set end date for these measures.
I think it's disgraceful. I mean, you're disrupting the whole college campus for a few students. They may have valid points or valid concerns, but they shouldn't disrupt the whole entire university and break the law by occupying some of the buildings.
Columbia is not just made up of a small section of people who are protesting. It's a very large campus, and you know, to have another graduation canceled again yet at Columbia University within the last 5 years, I think that would be something of a tragedy.
Over 1,000 Columbia alumni have written a letter to University President Shafeek asking her to remove the encampment and restore safety on campus. Students say that the university's silence has left many feeling alone.
Multiple institutions have called for police to arrest agitators. Meanwhile, the pro-Palestinian encampment at Yale University peacefully dispersed. Columbia has not yet announced any concrete actions it will take in response to the occupation of Hamilton Hall. Fiona G., NTD News.
Despite party divisions, both Republicans and Democrats in the House are showing support for the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. The bill could clear the lower chamber as soon as tomorrow. Our Washington correspondent Luis Martinez has more on this story.
The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act cleared the House Rules Committee, and it is expected to be put to a vote on the House floor this Wednesday. Representative Mike Lawler, the Republican from New York who introduced the bill last October, believes that the legislation would easily pass the House of Representatives, but has his doubts whether it will be picked up by the Senate.
Once it's passed through the House, it's really incumbent upon Chuck Schumer, the highest ranking Jewish official in American history, to act. And, you know, he's been noticeably silent on what is happening on college campuses across America.
I spoke with Congressman Adriano Espaillat, the Democrat from New York, and he showed no hesitation in supporting a legislation that would confront anti-Semitism in U.S. campuses.
I'm all against anti-Semitism. I got to take a look at the details. I've been a strong supporter of any legislation or any initiative that fights back against anti-Semitism.
I also spoke with Congressman Greg Kassar, the Democrat from Texas, and he was critical of some of the language in the bill, but conceded that he believes that it will pass the House floor with overwhelming support.
Criticizing the actions of a government isn't anti-Semitic. We actually want to criticize anti-Semitism in and of itself, condemn actual hatred and while also protecting people's free speech rights to criticize any government.
The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act would require the Education Department to adhere to the International Holocaust Remembers Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism when considering what is hate speech. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson went as far as to ask the President of the United States to take a moral stand when it comes to these issues.
We desperately need, the country needs, clear moral authority. We need the President of the United States to speak to the issue and say, this is wrong.
It's worth noting that on Tuesday, House Democrats released a statement signaling that they would oppose a motion to oust Speaker Mike Johnson. It is also important to mention that on Tuesday, Chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, Pete Aguilar, was critical of her colleague, Representative Ilhan Omar, over comments she made suggesting that some Jewish students in U.S. campuses were pro-genocide. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Luis Eduardo Martinez, NTD News.
The Biden administration taking a tougher tone as college protests escalate. The White House now calling the takeover of a campus building absolutely wrong. That says Trump compares college protests to January 6th. NTD's White House correspondent Iris Tao has more.
As students at Columbia University now forcibly occupied a campus building, the White House is condemning these protests as non-peaceful, adding that they're absolutely wrong.
The president believes that forcibly taking over a building on campus is absolutely the wrong approach. That is not an example of peaceful protest. Students paying to go to school and wanting an education ought to be able to do that without disruption. And they ought to be able to do it and feel safe doing it.
The White House adds that hate speech has no place in America. But the White House also makes clear that President Biden right now has no plans of sending in National Guards to stop these protests, despite House Speaker Mike Johnson calling on him to do so a week ago. Former President Trump, meanwhile, on Tuesday suggested that some of these protesters should face harsher consequences. Watch.
Well, they took over a building. That is a big deal. And I wonder if what's going to happen to them will be anything comparable to what happened to J6, because they're doing a lot of destruction, a lot of damages, a lot of people getting hurt very badly. I wonder if that's going to be the same kind of treatment they gave J6.
And Trump, in a new Time magazine interview published on Tuesday, says he would absolutely use the National Guard if the police were unable to stop these protests. Meanwhile, on a new ceasefire deal in Gaza, the White House on Tuesday again called on Hamas to accept what they called a generous offer from Israel that would pause the fighting in Gaza for 6 weeks and help to get some of the hostages home. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday vowed to still carry out a military operation in Rafah with or without a deal.
Until now. We will enter Rafah because we have no other choice. We will destroy the Hamas battalions there. We will complete all the objectives of the war, including the repatriation of all our abductees.
Netanyahu also vowed to evacuate the civilian population in Rafah to focus on the terrorists. And the White House is reiterating the message that the only thing standing in the way of a ceasefire is Hamas. Reporting from the White House, Iris Tao, NTD News.
Israeli forces continue to keep up the intensity against Hamas terrorists in the Gaza Strip. And at the same time, Israel is also facing terrorist attacks within its own borders. The Israeli police released a video showing one such incident. NTD's Jason Perry has the war update and a warning. This report contains footage that some viewers may find disturbing.
Crowds gathered as sirens sounded in the old city of Jerusalem on Tuesday. As seen in this video, a Turkish citizen walking closely behind two Israeli police officers pulls out a knife and starts stabbing one of the officers from behind. The officers then wrestled the man to the ground where they shot and killed him. The Israeli police officer who was stabbed received moderate injuries and was transported to a hospital. This attack comes just a week after Palestinian men in Jerusalem used their car to ram a group of Jewish men, then attempted to shoot at them, but their gun jammed in the process. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been in the Middle East trying to keep stability in the region. He was in Jordan on Tuesday, where he met with Jordan's king and other officials.
The United States remains the largest provider of humanitarian assistance and assistance in general. To the Palestinian people. And we're doing that in parallel with seeking to secure a ceasefire and the release of hostages.
After his trip to Jordan, Blinken flew to Israel, where he will try to advance the ceasefire talks as he wraps up his seventh trip to the Middle East since the war between Israel and Hamas began on October 7th. Meanwhile, the IDF is keeping up the intensity on Hamas terrorists in the Gaza Strip, reportedly striking an anti-tank missile launch post and other terror infrastructure. A resident in the Gaza Strip said he survived an apparent Israeli airstrike.
My mother is unwell and wounded, and she was asleep. And then something shook the area, and as you can see, the extent of the damage that is clearly in front of you came with no warning.
As of now, approximately 34,000 Palestinians have been killed since the war began, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. And of those killed, the IDF reported approximately 13,000 were Hamas terrorists, according to the Times of Israel. And just over 600 Israeli soldiers have been killed since the war began. And in another development, the United States military is helping to build a pier off the coast of the Gaza Strip to help deliver aid to the Palestinian people. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it should be ready to go in about a week. Jason Perry, NTD News.
Congress today probing next year's budget for the Department of Defense. The Biden administration proposed around $850 billion for the Pentagon for fiscal year 2025. That would be a 1% increase from the previous budget.
The 1% increase it proposes entirely is inadequate. It actually is a 2% cut when you factor in inflation.
Congressman Mike Rogers is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. On Tuesday, he criticized the Biden administration's proposed $850 billion defense budget. But he and the Pentagon acknowledged that the request was submitted consistent with the caps approved by Congress under the Financial Responsibility Act of 2023. Rogers admits that for this reason, Congress is partly to blame for the low budget. The Democratic ranking member agrees, saying it's hard to compete on the world stage with a tight budget.
China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and then various transnational terrorist groups, all of which are causing, challenges across the world. I don't disagree with the chairman's assessment of those challenges or how increasingly the problem is they are working together more and more.
Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz addressed this temporary pier the U.S. is building in Gaza. 1,000 armed U.S. soldiers will be stationed at the pier. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin says those troops could exchange fire with forces in Gaza if they're attacked.
President Biden told the country that we weren't going to have boots on the ground in Gaza.
And we won't.
Boots on a pier connected to the ground, connected to service members shooting into Gaza, doesn't count as boots on the ground?
It does not.
I think you're going to find the American people have a different perspective on that.
Gaetz added that if troops were to start shooting into Gaza, then their deployment should be approved by Congress. The U.S. released these new pictures on Monday, showing construction of the $300 million pier is ongoing. Its official goal is to deliver humanitarian aid. Virginia Gibson, NTD News.
Coming up, the Biden administration is hit with another lawsuit over rewrites to Title IX. NTD hears from one of the plaintiffs on how the president does not have the authority to make such major revisions. And the co-founder of Moms for Liberty joins us to discuss the impacts of those Title IX changes. Hear her explain why parents should care when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Four states, along with three advocacy groups, are the plaintiffs in one of the latest lawsuits against President Biden's recent updates to Title IX. The lawsuit alleges that the administration is overstepping its authority. NTD's Jason Blair reports.
The Biden administration finalized the updates with Title IX on April 19th. The changes broaden the 1972 statute to encompass discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, sex characteristics, and sex stereotypes. It also removes wording previously used to safeguard women's sports.
They don't have the power, basically, to make these kinds of sweeping changes to American civil rights law with a stroke of a pen.
Inez Stepman, the senior policy analyst for the Independent Women's Forum, a plaintiff in the case, says that if the Biden administration wants to include gender identity in the word sex, they need to go to Congress to change it.
Instead, they've done this end run around with this 1972 statute, which really not only does it not say that in the statute, it says the opposite.
The lawsuit was filed by the Independent Women's Forum, Parents Defending Education, Speech First, and the states of Alabama, Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina. The announcement was made Monday and said the rewrite makes women vulnerable in bathrooms and, quote, requires speech codes that indoctrinate young students with gender ideology. They also argue the regulation ends basic due process rights by, quote, limiting individuals accused of sexual harassment from defending themselves.
So we hope that courts, first of all, will stay this and prevent it from going into effect before we have our say in court. And then second, we'll strike this down, not just on administrative basis, not just because it's plainly not what the law says, that 1972 Title IX law, but also because it's just far beyond the power of the executive branch. It's far beyond the power of agencies of the Department of Education to be able to just completely rewrite the law this way.
Texas and Louisiana are also suing Biden over the new changes in a separate lawsuit announced yesterday. And today, Tennessee, West Virginia, Indiana, and former NCAA swimmer Riley Gaines announced a lawsuit as well. Jason Blair, NTD News.
Earlier, we spoke with Tiffany Justice, co-founder of Moms for Liberty, to dive into the changes to Title IX and how they impact parental rights. Tiffany Justice, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Wonderful to be here today. Thank you.
Now, following the Biden administration's changes to Title IX, Moms for Liberty actually released a letter on how it impacts parental rights. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've heard the issue about sports, biological boys playing in female sports a lot, right? But I want to talk about schools because I think it's really important for people to understand this rule was released through the Department of Education and is going to change everything that is happening with your child at that school, right? So impact to parental rights, many of you have heard about the secret transitions happening at school, social transitions, private, you know, conversations between children and adults at a school where a child changes their pronouns, their name at school. This will now have the stamp of the federal government in our schools, which puts a divide between the parent and the child that's just unconscionable.
Now, in the letter released, you're urging governors to take action against the Biden administration. Now, many states have filed lawsuits here. What are you hoping will come out of this?
We're hoping for a couple things. We like to see the head of education in the state saying to the school districts, hold, please. You need to wait. First of all, this rule doesn't go into effect until August 1st. And second of all, we expect that this rule is going to be held up in court, and we don't expect to have to implement changes for the next school year. You're right. The response has been amazing. And this week, you know, we sent that letter at the end of last week. This week, we've seen lawsuits from Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Montana, Idaho, Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina, some of them combining together. And so it's just been great to see a really robust reaction by the state to this total overreach of the federal government.
Zooming in on the education part, you kind of touched on this earlier, how it's not just about sports in the locker room, but actually this new change makes gender identity a federally protected class. And it's also allowing school officials to be what are known as, quote, confidential reporters. It removes the parents from the conversation about children who are minors, right, and who are suffering from what they're calling gender identity struggles. Now, what is this doing to the family dynamic if parents are removed from that conversation?
parents have the fundamental right to direct the upbringing of their children. That's their education, their medical care, their morality, their religion. The fact that the school thinks that they may know better than a parent, if they feel like a parent might be unsupportive of a child's wish to change their gender, that they feel they can intercede, that they can, you know, go between the parent and the child and somehow cut the parent out of the child's life when the child is experiencing extreme mental distress is shocking to us at Moms for Liberty. And we, again, you know, called upon all of these governors and different leaders in the states to take a stand. We'd also like to see some of these states stop taking federal funding when possible, because the idea that the federal government is, you know, saying we're going to take away lunch money if you don't follow our rules. Well, you know, you can take your lunch money and shove it, federal government, because the truth is there are boys and there are girls and no child is born in the wrong body.
Given this whole gender identity thing that is being pushed and how life-changing a lot of these procedures would be, how do you read the overwhelming response so far, if you will, to your letter? How is this, in a way, a uniting issue?
I think it's a uniting issue for parents. You know, parents have this bond across racial lines, religious lines. We're all parents, and we all believe that we have the right to direct the upbringing of our kids. So it is bringing people together. For American parents, we're watching as countries like Sweden and Finland and Denmark, they're taking a step back and they're saying, wait, this gender-affirming care model that we've been using may not be what's best for kids. American parents just saw the CAS review, a new report that was released by a pediatrician from England that said gender-affirming care carries with it a lot of risks for children. And so it's very odd to see the federal government pushing gender ideology in our schools at the same moment that you have a world that's waking up to the real harms of gender ideology. It's a clash like I don't think we've seen in maybe ever.
And when it comes to the response to your letter so far, what is next for Moms for Liberty when it comes to these changes to Title IX?
We're releasing a toolkit this week that's going to really give parents all of the answers that they want to try to find. You know, this information is sometimes difficult to decipher, especially for parents that haven't been navigating the world of civil rights and education. So we're going to have a toolkit, and we're going to have things like a template to send to your school board to ask them what's happening right now in your school district regarding Title IX. Are there planned changes so that you can, you know, allow for your family to get ready to deal with any issues that may arise. We'll also be looking to, you know, be able to help and support in lawsuits around the country as needed.
Tiffany Justice, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Marijuana could be demoted in its risk classification. Multiple outlets report the Justice Department will move to loosen federal restrictions on marijuana. Right now, it's considered a Schedule I drug, which means it has no medical use and a high potential for abuse. Other drugs in that category include heroin and LSD. The Justice Department reportedly wants to move it to Schedule III. Those substances are considered to have moderate to low potential for dependence. The category includes things like Tylenol with codeine and anabolic steroids. Once the DOJ makes the recommendation, it will take months to take effect after a public comment period. Neither the Justice Department nor White House have confirmed the change. Coming up, former President Trump calls the gag order in his New York criminal trial unconstitutional. A guest joins us to explain the legality of the gag order when we come back. Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, here are some of today's top headlines. Anti-Israel protesters at Columbia University took over a building on campus and barricaded themselves inside as the deadline to disperse expired. Amid the chaos, Columbia closed its campus to non-residential students and the media. The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act cleared a procedural vote in the House with broad support from both Republicans and Democrats. The bill could clear the lower chamber as soon as tomorrow. The White House also commented on the occupation of the Columbia building, calling it absolutely wrong. This came as the Biden administration called on Hamas to accept Israel's latest ceasefire proposal. Former President Trump was in court for day 9 of his New York hush money trial. The judge ruled that Trump violated the gag order 9 times and fined him $9,000. Joining us now to explain Trump's gag order in the New York criminal trial is Janice Heisel, reporter at the Epoch Times. She did a special report on the gag order recently and spoke with many legal experts. Janice, thank you so much for joining us. Great to see you again. Now, bring us up to speed on what happened in court today and Trump's response.
Well, the judge did issue that $9,000 fine. That was $1,000 for each of nine Truth Social posts that the judge thought violated his order. Now, five of those seven posts were made by the former president himself, and two were by his campaign. And most of those focused on his ex-lawyer, Michael Cohen, who is considered a key witness in the case. Now, the judge ordered these posts to be removed today, and I did check, and it does look like that all of those posts were removed. If the former president and his staff did not remove those posts, he was looking at possibly being thrown in jail.
And Janice, how are people reacting to the judge's decision to hold Trump in contempt?
Supporters of the former president are actually reposting screenshots of these forbidden posts saying, hey, these are the posts that the judge doesn't want you to see. So that's kind of an interesting reaction there. And legal analyst Jonathan Turley, he has pointed out several apparent contradictions in this judge's order. For example, the judge says on one hand, hey, you know, it doesn't look like any other courts have ruled whether a simple reposting of someone else's words or an article violates a gag order. And normally under these circumstances, Mr. Turley said that the judge would issue a clarifying order, but instead he issued punishment. And finally, President Trump himself made a statement after court today. He said he was honored to be the Republican nominee, but it's terrible and unconstitutional to restrict his speech under these circumstances. In fact, he called this situation a disgrace.
Now, the gag order itself has been subject to a lot of debate. What is that debate about?
Mainly, that debate centers on two controversies. Is it fair, or is that order unconstitutional? The fairness of it is being debated because it is a one-sided order. Now, normally when judges issue a gag order to restrict people's speech in any kind of a criminal or civil case, the idea is that it's generally applied to all parties, prosecution, defense, and any witnesses or anybody connected to the case in any way. This order, however, focuses only on President Trump and his team, not on the prosecution. So the fairness is very much debatable here because it allows his critics, such as Mr. Cohen, his former lawyer, to go out and say whatever he wants publicly, and President Trump is pretty much stuck and just can't respond. Now, on the constitutional question, that is, you know, one of the biggest things that makes it a huge question here is that this is happening in the context of a presidential election, which has ramifications for our entire nation. And so that is another huge reason this is being debated.
Given all that you just laid out, how is the judge justifying his order?
This all came about because the prosecutors complained that Trump has intimidated people, they say, with his social media posts. They say that, you know, they're expressing concern that witnesses might be reluctant to participate in the trial. And the judge said, okay, so I'm going to tailor this order narrowly to protect President Trump's free speech rights while protecting the integrity of the criminal process.
On that note, could the gag order be reversed?
Yes, President Trump's lawyers have appealed. And also, an independent New York lawyer who has no connection to Trump or his team, he's just a concerned citizen who happens to be an attorney in New York. He has filed a challenge, and I believe that's due for a hearing next week. He argues that any gag order must be tied to an effort to protect someone's constitutional rights. Usually, it's the right of the defendant to a fair trial, and it's going against the prosecution from making all kinds of statements in the public that could taint the jury pool. But Judge Marchand's order makes no such linkage, according to this lawyer, and he says it's just to further the state's interest in the fair administration of justice. But the problem with that is that claim could be made about virtually any scenario. And so this could possibly encourage prosecutors to start trying to seek gag orders against whoever might be in front of a judge. And that could pose a concern for every American. In fact, one expert I talked to told me this is much bigger than Trump.
Janice Heisel, reporter at the Epoch Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Four police officers are dead and another four were shot and wounded in Charlotte, North Carolina yesterday. The main suspect was also killed. Law enforcement is now questioning two others.
The U.S. Marshals has a fugitive task force that we are a part of that they went to go and serve the warrant as any other day that they would do. And unfortunately, this individual decided to greet them with gunfire, and it just turned into a tragic event for the officers that were originally out on the scene and then the officers that responded to try and assist.
The officers were serving a warrant for possession of a firearm by a convicted felon in the Shannon Park neighborhood. Police identified the suspect as Terry Clark Hughes Jr. Four other officers were shot and wounded but are in stable condition. A solemn procession in Charlotte earlier today paid tribute to one of the officers killed. Authorities are investigating the incident. President Biden reacted to the shooting, calling the officers heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice. The Senate today explored how Chinese money laundering organizations are profiting from fentanyl trafficking. But is the CCP involved in this business? NTD's Sam Wong has the story.
$1 billion in annual revenue, driven by one of the deadliest narcotics in the world. On Tuesday, the Senate Caucus on International Narcotics Control delved into China's money laundering efforts in the fentanyl supply chain.
Chinese money laundering organizations have gotten very good at shielding ill-gotten gains. These organizations launder cartel cash quicker and cheaper than competitors, often with a money-back guarantee.
Of all drug overdoses in the U.S., fentanyl remains a primary perpetrator. A small amount that fits on the tip of a pencil is enough to be lethal. Fentanyl productions can be traced all the way back to mainland China, where most of the drug's precursor chemicals are made. Experts say combating the flow of fentanyl requires international efforts.
Criminals based in the People's Republic of China have emerged as the professional money launderers of choice for Mexican drug traffickers seeking to move their funds around the world. But this is a global problem, and global problems require global solutions.
According to a recent report by the House Select Committee on the CCP, fentanyl kills an average of more than 200 Americans per day, which leads to a record drop in life expectancies across the country. The report says the Chinese Communist Party has been directly subsidizing the production and exports of fentanyl precursors through tax rebates.
Through these subsidies, the Chinese government is supporting the flow of fentanyl into the United States and other countries. It doesn't matter what part of our country, which political party you're in, this is just tearing families, communities apart.
As of this year, fentanyl has been front and center at several diplomatic meetings between Washington and Beijing. During a trip to China last week, Secretary of State Antony Blinken addressed the communist regime's role in supplying the synthetic opioid. And earlier this month, President Biden also raised the issue of fentanyl in a phone call with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Sam Wong, NTD News.
Coming up, growing demand for electricity is in large part coming from the AI industry. We hear from a tech expert about how the demand for data centers is creating a critical power gap. And in the NBA, LeBron James' Lakers have been eliminated from the playoffs. So what's his future hold? Dave Martin joins us to discuss his options when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. The boom in data centers could create a critical electricity shortage in the coming years. NTD's Daniel Monahan spoke with Dr. Eric Woodle, a tech infrastructure management company founder, for analysis.
Data centers, the so-called brains of the internet, are industrial warehouses packed with rows upon rows of servers. They process, communicate, and store the data behind everything from bank records, online retailers, and social media platforms, to Netflix shows and your personal iPhone videos. Many analysts laud data centers as one of the fastest-growing sectors of the real estate market. But the industry may soon find itself hitting a wall as local communities put up increasing resistance to its seemingly insatiable appetite for power and water. A January report by Newmark, a commercial real estate advisory firm, says growth is increasingly held back by land and power availability. The report said the rapid growth of AI and other technologies is fueling the demand. Data warehouses consumed 17 gigawatts of electricity in 2022, or about 4% of total U.S. consumption. That is projected to double to 35 gigawatts by 2030. Eric Woodell, the founder of the tech infrastructure management company Ameris, referred to data centers as energy hogs.
The increased power demand due to data centers coming online and electric vehicles is growing at the same time that our government is reducing power production through fossil fuel power plants.
Woodell says they're predicting an 83 gigawatt gap between demand and power production within the next 3.5 years.
And 83 gigawatt sounds like a lot of power, obviously. In comparison, New York City is 5.5. So the gap is massive, and it's going to have major impacts on us down the road.
The Ameris founder says a mere 10-foot square space within the average data center consumes about 10 times as much electricity as the average home. According to Woodell, AI computing puts much higher demands on energy, using 5 to 10 times more power than traditional computing. Daniel Monahan, NTD News.
And now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin at the Sports Hub. Now, Dave, a lot going on today, but let's start in the NBA, where LeBron James and the Lakers were bounced from the playoffs last night by Denver. Now, this brings up questions regarding James's future. Has he said what his plans are?
No, and he's pretty much got every option available to him. I mean, he can retire, of course. He can opt out of his contract and either re-sign with the Lakers, or he could become a free agent and sign with any team. Also, he can actually opt into his player option next season with the Lakers for $51 million. Now, I think it's gonna be important to him how good he thinks the Lakers are gonna be next season. Now, this first round loss here to Denver, I mean, it doesn't really look very good on paper. Now, here is the Western Conference standings. As you can see, the Pelicans are eliminated, so are the Suns. The Nuggets beat the Lakers in just 5 games, but the Lakers actually led at halftime in all 5 of those games. They ended up somehow losing 4 of them, but 2 of them were by buzzer beaters by the same guy, Jamal Murray. And the Nuggets, I mean, they're the defending champs, so it was a tough series. James, meanwhile, he's 39. He still looks great. He played very well in this series. I think he wants to come back, but I think he wants to play for a contender. I'm not sure that that's the Lakers, though.
Well, looking at the Eastern Conference, we have 3 games on tonight, including one with a beat-up Milwaukee team that's facing elimination. What is the status of their 2 injured All-Stars?
Yeah, both Giannis Antetokounmpo and Damian Lillard are listed as doubtful for tonight's game, which is unfortunate for them. Giannis, he's got a calf injury. He's been out for the last 3 weeks with it. Dame, he injured his Achilles in Game 3, so he already missed Game 4. That's a very, very tough time. I mean, Lillard, they went out and acquired in the offseason. Took a lot to get him, but they thought pairing him with Giannis would make them a championship contender team. And I agree, those two together are very good, but they're out for the most inopportune time of the year. And when they're out, well, I mean, this is what's happened. Here's the whole standings. They're down 3-1 to the Pacers right now. With their backs against the wall, they cannot afford one more loss. They're still waiting on those two to come back, meanwhile. Now, that's just one of 3 games we've got going on tonight. We also have the Cavs versus the Magic, Game 5 there in a series tied at 2. And also Game 5 in New York City at Madison Square Garden. The Knicks try to close out the Sixers. They're up 3-1. Always closing out a team, though, is the toughest win of all.
Now moving to women's sports, a study is being conducted in England to look into why women's soccer players were at least 2 times more likely to suffer ACL injuries than men. Now, what kinds of factors will they be looking at?
Yeah, this study is called Project ACL, and it's reportedly be focused more on environmental issues like lack of proper footwear, how heavy the workload is, like, you know, they're playing back-to-back games or something. That's instead of looking at the mechanics of female bodies and how they differentiate from men. Now, on that subject, there was actually doctors at Northwestern as well as Johns Hopkins Medicine who have published information online about this issue that showed that the problem is really more internal. Women's ACL tissue, this is a ligament, by the way, that goes through your knee, is actually thinner than men's, and they have generally less muscle area around the knee that makes it more unstable. At any rate, they recommend using proper techniques when training and playing, and work to develop your muscle groups evenly and definitely work on your core.
Shifting gears to the NHL now, we have four playoff games on tonight with four teams on the brink of elimination, including Toronto. What is the status of Maple Leaf center Austin Matthews, who's been ill?
Yeah, it's a game time decision, and it's a big one. Austin Matthews led the league with 69 goals scored this season. That's the most in the NHL since 1996, when Hall of Famer Mario Lemieux did it for Pittsburgh. Now, he only has one in this four-game set thus far, and Toronto has only scored seven times in those four games, probably why they're down 3-1. Now, they had a team skate today. Apparently, he didn't stay on the ice for very long, though. It certainly seems like he's trying his best. Now, elsewhere tonight in the NHL, Carolina looks to put away the New York Islanders at home. Vancouver ditto over Nashville in Vancouver. Colorado leads Winnipeg 3-1. They could close out tonight, too. Now, the Avalanche are being led by defenseman Cale Makar. He's got 8 points through the four games. That's the second most in these NHL playoffs. And he helped lead them to a Stanley Cup title just 2 years ago. So maybe he does it again.
Well, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tiff.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.